It was some time later that I came down from the mountains onto a vast plain not far from Alexandria Araucasia. The far side of the mountains had been green and lush, and I had never gone wanting for shade, but from the plain where I stood the promontory looked forbidding, like a mass of broken glass blasted by the wind with ash and lime. It had long been said that there was a temple nearby, one which was known from Chainon to the Bosphorus, renowned for the wealth of its treasury and the splendor of its construction. I met many who claimed to have gone there as pilgrims, but none could remember where it lay on the plain. I had paused to drink a swig of water when a dust storm blew in, and I could hardly see the leather jug I held before my face. It might have been a minute, or it might have been an hour, before the winds dwindled and the dust settled back to earth. To my amazement, I saw a gigantic structure not half a mile away, people filing in and out, dressed in the most fantastical colors and forms. How I could have missed this, I could not dare to say. I followed the flow of the people into a large space, open to the air but canopied in wood, a structure of dazzling complexity, and became accustomed to their mode of meditation and thanksgiving. After a long while, there began a procession around the space. In the front was the highest priest, dressed in the character of one of their gods, with a monstrous beak and plumage in the wildest colors. Behind was the company of high priests, wearing robes of the deepest scarlet. These priests walked in pairs, carrying enormous wooden trunks between them, and chanting toward the god, "All these gifts we give to you." From time to time, the god would stop and turn to the priests and chant in return, "And all these gifts I give to you." An older man explained to me that the people of Alexandria Araucasia and the neighboring villages would come to watch the processions and give thanks for the wealth of the temple and the care of the gods, which ensured their prosperity and their safety. Each chest contained a portion of the temple's treasures, images of the god in obsidian or lapis or solid gold, jewels and stones beyond imagination. Only the high priests were permitted to see these treasures, and among them were great scholars who knew which idols should be paraded on which days according to the cycles of the stars. "Look," the old man said, "how they strain against the weight. Look," he said, "how they balance the load between them with perfect faith and practiced grace." The procession made a circuit of the space several times, the priests in front pulling the people along behind, tighter and faster with every round, as though all of them had been sucked into a whirlpool together. In time, the priests filed out through a dark passage. Each of the people following behind would linger a moment at the edge of this place, their eyes useless and numb against the depth of the shadows, before bowing and making way for those who stood behind. When my turn came, I looked into the dark, and closed my eyes, full of wonder. And when I opened them again, a priest stood before me, only inches away. He said, "You will come with me." At the other end of the passage was a courtyard, vast in extent, filled with a forest of columns. Their capitals were made of turquoise and gold, and flared out like ferns high above. Despite the heat of the day, the courtyard was cool, almost cold in places, for the columns in their great height blotted out much of the sun. I thought I heard some owls call from deep inside the dark. I was taken to a small cell along one of the courtyard's walls. "You," he said, "will live here, and wear these brown robes like the other novices of the cult. The inner treasury is for the high priests alone. You may go anywhere else." And so I embarked on a new journey, each day full of thanksgiving, reflection, scholarship, and good works. I learned the art of astronomical calculations, for which I had some hidden aptitude, collected donations, comforted the poor, and learned some of the useful crafts, masonry, and woodwork, to aid in the upkeep of the temple. These labors suited me, and tired from the endless days of walking that had come before, I thought less and less of the road to Samarkand. More than a year passed in this way. It was the height of summer when I noticed some of the other novices beginning to distance themselves from me at meals, a sign that I had displeased the god, or else pleased him very well. From time to time, the ranks of high priests were replenished from among the mass of the novices, a procession stopping at the cell of the elect and taking him away into the inner treasury. Some of those who had been chosen would emerge again a few days later, clad in scarlet robes and sternly silent on the mysteries of what had taken place. The rest were never seen or heard from again. One morning, very early, it was my turn. I heard a buzz like distant bees, and then the beat of drums, and then the song I'd heard so many times. I opened my door, and now they sang these words to me, these priests. All these gifts we give to you. And the god sings to me too. All these gifts I give to you. Now we are cloistered in the inner treasury, a modest, dark space, uncarved wood, nothing gilt. The trunks from the processions lie in vast, neat stacks around the edges of the room. At the center of the furthest wall, there stands a wardrobe. "Do you know what this is?" the god says, pointing at the wardrobe, his feathers in the starkest stillness, even as he speaks. I have never seen it before, so I cannot say. But in other temples, such closets hold the holiest relics of all, or so it has been told to me. There is a silence. A fly lands on the god's nose briefly, before alighting again and spiraling up and up towards heaven. "We think you know the true nature of our faith," he says. "By my good word, I must confess, I am only a novice. I cannot tell you the true nature of our faith, though I know many of the things that it is not." He pauses again. "Your calculations are always precise," he says, "and your dedication to good works is never flagging. And you have never asked to be permitted inside the treasury, though you have taken more than your rations of wine on numerous occasions. I know well to avoid that which is forbidden for good reason, and that which is forbidden for other reasons. If I have sometimes taken too much wine, I pray that it has improved my concentration and my calculations, and I believe it to be so." He nods absently. Then he stands beside me, gripping my arm, and we walk toward the wardrobe together. Two of the priests advance beyond us, and the doors are pulled open, and inside the wardrobe, there is nothing. Bathed in darkness and shade, the room feels very hot. "Do you understand?" he asks me. "I understand that this temple has thrived 200 years and more, and that the town has long been prosperous and safe. Do you understand?" he asks me again, his fingernails pressing into my arm. "I understand that the gods must smile on our temple and appreciate our never-ending labors, even though the wardrobe is empty, and all the trunks as well. Do you understand?" He sounds urgent, almost frightened. "I understand that our people are industrious and kind, that a beautiful dream can hold the vaults of heaven, and that never, all these years, was there ever any treasure here." He begins to release his grip. "You have known all along," he asks. "I have always known it," I say, "even before I ever knew of this temple." He lets me go completely. I turn to him. In his other hand is a dagger, flashing brilliant even in the faint light, which he sets down on the ground as he turns to embrace me. I am left alone to reflect and give thanks, and when I emerge, it is in robes of the deepest scarlet, which I wear for 3 more years of processions, calculations, and careful instruction of the novices. And then one night I wake in the darkest hour, the night air a wash of cold against the sweat of my fever. I sit up straight, as though commanded in a dream, and I say the words softly, "Samarkand." I dress for a journey beneath my priestly garb, walk out of my cell, pass out through the temple, and once outside the complex walls, I watch the threads of my scarlet robe dance and fray and snap in the remains of a vagrant's fire. As I walk into the desert again, I fix my eyes straight ahead, as though an errant glance might somehow cause my flight to be discovered. When I feel I can dare it, I turn around. but the dust has blown in, and the temple is gone.